For the record, Jimmy Housley with Jordan Newman as chair of DEEB, and maybe I'll start with Brent, and you guys can work your way around the room from there.
Keep going. Andrew Gunther with PLS Engineering.
Eric Galimo, SGA Engineering.
Seth Hauling, AKS Engineering.
Mike Odron, Olson Engineering.
Dan Weisner, Songbird Homes.
Sherry Jones, Southwest Washington Contractors Association.
Brent Davis, Community Development.
April Firth, Community Development.
And who's behind you, April?
She doesn't have a mic at her seat.
Okay.
No. Noelle Leverin with BIA of Clark County.
Thank you, Noelle. Okay, moving to those online, I see Kim. Kim's got to come off mute. Diana.
Hi.
Diana Nutt, Development Engineering.
Jennifer.
Jennifer Reynolds, Development Engineering.
Jacob.
Jacob Harner, Development Engineering.
Kyla. Another one not muted. Nick, you want to introduce yourself?
Yeah, hi, Nick Flagg with Clark Public Utilities.
Okay, is there anybody else that I missed either in the room or online that wants to introduce themselves? Okay, with that, a reminder that DEEB meetings are being recorded and the audio will be posted on the DEEB website after the meeting. The first order of business is to review and adopt the minutes from May. Mr. Odron.
I have just perused and don't see any corrections, so I would move for approval.
Is there a second?
One item for correction is the discussion where it says understand about the neck pickiness and thoroughness. I think it's supposed to be nitpickiness and thoroughness, but minor item. But other than that, I second.
How nitpicky. Okay, it's been moved and seconded. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
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 Okay, passes. Is there any DEEB member announcements?
Yeah, I do, Mr. Chair.
Yes.
Last month, there was a group of us that got together online and had a discussion with April with regards to the certification of landscape installation on subdivisions, specifically for the buffer landscaping. And I believe it was decided, I don't know if we've heard back from April as far as memorializing this, but typically the right-of-way landscaping that needs to be installed prior to final plat is installed, but those that are along the front of single-family residential lots, those street trees and landscaping are installed at the time of the house construction and need a landscape certification prior to occupancy. I think we've landed the plane now that the buffer landscaping that had previously to be installed prior to final plat recording, in which subsequently either got damaged, destroyed, or died during the construction of the house and needed to be replanted, will now be, and you can confirm this, April, but we'll also go through the same landscape certification process similar to what we do for the street trees. It's a process that Diana and I set up years ago to where the contractor will send me pictures of the tree and enough information to know what lot it's on or the address or whatever. I can double check that against the final landscape plan and on GIS to confirm that that is the exact lot, and I can see what kind of tree it is and the size of the tree and certify it that way without having to make an individual site visit for each single lot that needs to be certified. So the similar process will be done as far as the buffer landscaping also. So I might see if that's been...
Yes, that's true. The only, I would say the only clarification is that the buffer for the subdivision, not tied to a single location, would still have to be done at the plat recording. So if there was any landscaping that had to be done as a buffer of the whole entire subdivision that wasn't tied to the individual lots.
Yep, that makes sense.
Yeah.
Yep. So we've landed that plane after a 10-year discussion. So we're done.
Okay. Thank you, Mike. Is there any other team member announcements?
I had one other quick one. I attended the or watched the work session for the board had on the vacant buildable lands model, and it definitely took a twist. So there was a motion, and it doesn't sound like a huge change, but one of a significant motion was to use achieved density instead of the targets that were projected, like a projected density. And that means a lot, because what they found is that in the last few years in the city of Vancouver, across the city, they're averaging in our development area 18 units per acre, and the projection is 8 moving forward. So if they use that 18, which I would argue is a lot of kind of one-off projects, it's a lot of development inside the urban core with high rises, things like that, where it really skews that density up. And the question is that what we're going to see in the future? Was this a single situation? And then what's the ramifications of using that to project forward? And what it basically means is that we're not going to need new land to meet our needs. And what I think the difference is that might fill one particular need in our community, but not all of them. So the other thing it does too is it puts people in apartments instead of having the opportunity for home ownership and the opportunity to like own your unit and have that potential for generational wealth. So it is a significant issue. It also potentially could be a self-fulfilling prophecy, where what we found is, you know, in the industry, the reason this bill was written was because there's an apparent shortage of buildable land and an issue with affordability. So because we have this shortage of land out there that's easily developable, it's pushing people into apartments, which then skews the numbers that way. And then by planning for that in the future, we tend to only plan for that. So it, like I said, it becomes a self-fulfilling prophecy. The other issue we have with the development of the downtown core is that it's not necessarily affordable. That is very expensive to develop, very expensive units. It doesn't fulfill that affordability item and need in our community. So on average, I mean, you're looking at those apartments down there that they're building, you're talking $2,500, $3,000 a month for a single bedroom unit. That is not, you can get a house for that if they were available. Problem is we don't have them available. They're not building them. We don't have the right zone for it. And based on this new finding of using 18 units per acre in the remaining Vancouver urban growth boundary, it basically cuts down the need for additional land in other areas, which would fulfill other needs. So I'm not sure how we're going to address that. We may want to tackle that. The hearing is Tuesday, and we're up against a deadline. I know a few people are working on it. There's a few of us. I know Jerry from your office is involved, myself, the Realtor Association, the BIA is also involved. Jamie's part of that group as well. So we need to get that message across, and it could have significant ramifications if they move forward with that for the direction of our community in the future. So just bring it to everyone's attention. We have participated in that through, I think Jamie and I have kind of been our liaisons for that process, but I wanted to bring it to your attention because it is significant. I don't know that it needs more discussion. I know that we've kind of been on the same page, but if there is any different direction that I can get from anyone here, Jamie and I and the rest of the group can, you know, take that to the board as well. So, Jamie, did I miss anything?
No, he hit the nail on the header.
So, but big issue. So just wanted to bring it to everyone's attention.
So, Eric, is that the difference between, I mean, have you guys looked at the difference between what was the density that was, you know, in the zoning and the density achieved? Or, I mean, is that just overall, this is what was developed within the city of Vancouver?
This was since the adoption of the last growth plan in the city of Vancouver's urban growth boundary. Now, what's not happened is they haven't really expanded their urban growth boundary that much. We haven't seen a lot of that development yet. There's been things in place like, you know, some of the developments on 192nd, we haven't seen that yet. That hasn't even hit the market. Pretty much the only development we've seen in the city of Vancouver over that time period has been dense stuff downtown. So yes, it's going to skew those numbers. And when you look at the available land and the density we're getting on that land, it's going to throw the whole thing off. And if we use those numbers moving forward, it's, you know, what it's basically going to say is that we don't need any more land to meet our needs. We have the study right now without that, with 8 units per acre, said we had plenty in our urban growth boundary for the next 20 years. Using 18 per acre basically is going to say we have not only that, but we have twice as much as we need. And, you know, there'll be no incentive if they adopt that when they look at the new urban growth plan to add new land to the boundary, which will significantly impact, you know, our community moving forward. And just the character, I guess, of our community. It's you know, personally, I'm passionate about giving people the opportunity for home ownership, and that, you know, it widens the gap between the haves and the have-nots. And when you look at that difference, owning your home versus renting is one of the things that separates those two groups. And it makes it more and more difficult for those have-nots to become haves. And it's just, I don't know, I think it's a very detrimental to our community, and we need to get that across to the board and to, I think, staff in the cities that are making the decisions. But
was this a PC hearing you went to or the council hearing?
It was a council work session. And it was okay. Brought up as, like, we don't have a choice because the RCW says you have to look at achieved density. Now, Jamie has a different interpretation, the legal interpretation. It says you have to look at it. It doesn't say you have to use it. But Jamie, you can probably speak to that more.
What have we been using in the past?
Projections based on the zoning,
right?
Not based on what has actually developed. So it does skew it because we haven't seen those densities, those lower density stuff develop because there's not infrastructure to it. And they haven't annexed it, and they haven't, like, there's not much added. They didn't add much last urban growth plan. So we have a huge shortage, especially in the city of Vancouver. All that's available is multifamily land in basically commercial areas. So, you know, we're building mid-rise apartments to house our future population instead of homes. Mm-hmm. So.
Yeah, I was looking for the statute I sent you yesterday, Eric. Well, to cut to the quick, the way that the Washington Administrative Code reads is, as Eric correctly characterizes it, it's supposed to be, that's one of the things that you need to look at. And from my point of view, they're not being consistent with the spirit of the recent legislation, which was to account for market conditions in housing. And they're not harmonizing both of those obligations. And so they're taking a very strict, literal achieved density without understanding the context of the statute, first of all, but also what the program's trying to achieve, which is make sure that we have affordable housing within our communities and within our region. So I think needless to say is there'll probably be some letters coming from various parties to respond to what the board did last week in its work session. And it's a little bit frustrating that they elected to make those policy decisions there without having it be in a public forum for comment.
But since it was a work session, no policy decisions were made, right?
Well, I guess it's they got a
on a work session.
Yeah, with Lance Olson and Councillor Rylander to move forward with that I think it should help prepare the hearing on next Tuesday. So there's still opportunity to have our voice heard for them, and maybe they'll make it. It's the hope.
Okay, you're kind of cutting out, Jamie.
Yeah, I'll try to speak up.
There you go.
Well, a clarifying question. I mean, what I was asking was, okay, so if they're, if you guys were looking at stuff, did they achieve 80% of the projected density for that zone, or, you know, 60, or are they right at 100%, or that's kind of a, because I, when I look at, you know, the vacant available lands model that we have right now, we have a lot of, you know, R110, R120, and so, you know, there's no way we're going to develop that at 15. And I know what you're saying is that inside the city of Vancouver, that's what they have achieved. But I mean, there's just not that much land left.
That is the challenge. And they're not breaking out by zone. They're breaking it up by UGA. So basically what they're saying is Vancouver UGA, they are projecting now if they use achieved density, they're going to get 18 units per acre on the vacant lands that they have right now. Now, the problem is they're getting that from lands that weren't even considered vacant because we're taking commercial buildings and they're building stuff over the top of it. So, look, I mean, the waterfront's a perfect example. Is that a one-off? I mean, are we going to see a lot more stuff like that? Is that market going to be saturated? Is there that many people can afford, you know, those types of units per month rental? And does that actually fulfill the entire need in our community? And I think the obvious answer is no, it doesn't. I mean, by using just those types of units, it actually cannibalizes the other potential housing types that we do need. And I guess one side would argue that, you know, our UGA, like now our population is primarily single family residential, but that's where the demand is. That's what this community is like built around. That was kind of the character of this community. This, we're not, you know, the Pearl District or downtown Portland. You know, we do have more of a, you know, there's some different feels, and I think we need everything. We do need that downtown development. It's great. It provides a great need in our community. It just can't be at the expense of all the other needs in our community. And even other high density needs, like garden style apartments tend to rent for about half of what the downtown stuff rents for. That's what a certain percentage of the population can afford. So we need to still have those garden style apartments that we see out in like Orchards or, you know, north of Salmon Creek. You know, those kind of needs are still valid and shouldn't be cannibalized by just mid-rise apartments in the downtown area. So, not sure if we need like a motion. I mean, I think we have it covered. Unfortunately, they've kind of said that, oh, they already made a motion to use achieved density. Now, I mean, not that they can't reverse it, but that basically starts from scratch. I mean, we've been working on this for 2.5 years. I have no idea how they're going to rerun this model by next Tuesday when they have 1 week to rerun it. My guess is it's already done. They already had it before they made the motion, and it's done and ready to go, but we'll see. So took 2 years to do the first one. So.
Yeah, and then I did find the WAC guide. If you want to peruse it in more detail, it's WAC 365, 196, 315. And specifically, I think where the majority of council is hanging their hat on based on what the city of Vancouver was saying is 5A, Roman numeral 2, where it talks about should compare the achieved densities, but but then you look up above in the rest of the WAC and it talks sort of about what Dan's talking about is, you know, you're supposed to look at the nexus between what you assume the zoning is and what you may actually be seeing on the ground. And unfortunately, I think that's being twisted in some respects to try to achieve a different result. And that's definitely what we have to comment on. Okay, moving along, the only other member announcement is Jeff had contacted me prior to the meeting today, and he had something come up last minute, so I know he'll not be here. And Brent, I realized I was very rude, and I skipped over the upcoming events. If you have any to discuss? Obviously, we talked about the council hearing next week, but.
Yeah, just to be clear, that that council hearing is Tuesday at 10 a.m., so a morning hearing. Aside from that, there are no work sessions on the schedule, no other hearings that are of particular interest to this board. And the only other thing I have is the commercial industrial development position is currently advertised and will be closing in a couple of weeks. And we've had one individual express interest so far.
Okay, wonderful.
That's what I've
got. So that'll be closing next week?
A couple of weeks.
Oh, okay. Because I know that we had talked about it'd be nice to have an architect on the board, and I think that
You're either going to need to do that by which there's currently no vacancies, appointment of an at-large position, or we're going to need to amend the bylaws.
Oh, okay. So, gotcha. So the industrial commercial is not someone who's in that industry, or?
Well, it could be an architect if they specialize in that field. That is correct.
Yeah, so I think what we were thinking about before. Okay. So we've still got 2 weeks then.
June 21st is the official close date for that.
Okay. Thank you.
Okay. Moving along to the first item of the agenda, the landscaping and recreational space interim ordinance, and I will turn it over to April.
I don't know if I can talk for 20 minutes about this, but we've already had a lot of discussion, but I do want to say I'm sorry about the misunderstanding. I was waiting for the revisions to be sent. I didn't realize there wasn't any revisions and to send it on. So I will be talking to council early next week about it, and I hope that we will find a way that makes us both happy. That is my plan. So I will have an update early next week or mid next week.
So how do you suggest, so a project that is caught up right now with the pending decision, it's a draft decision right now, on hold, the client would love to see it finalized and start moving forward, but it has these conditions in it. So if we accepted it today, we'd have to do a post-decision review, a lot more cost, a lot more effort, not just for you guys who are short-staffed, but also for us, a lot of waste of resources. We'd like to avoid that. Is there anything we can do to move that along without having to keep it on hold and without having to do a post-decision review in the future?
Yes, I think we're legal and I are looking into right now if there is an option to be able to do that. I will know by mid next week.
Okay.
Yep.
Sounds good.
If there's something we can do right now. Yep.
We have one in that situation and the client's like not really happy that it's still on hold, but we're telling them, you know, we could accept the conditions as they are, but it's gonna cost you money and probably not save you time in the long run. So we're just in limbo.
Are you in a draft right now?
Yep. Yeah. But it's been draft for like 2-3 weeks now. Yeah. And it may be another 2-3, I don't know how long until the interim ordinance is adopted.
If I have to go that route.
Okay.
I'm trying to find a quicker one.
Okay, that'd be great. Yep. Thank you.
Okay, any other questions for April? So April, will that pass board come in and email back to the D members next week?
Everyone that's on the original communication of the whole chain, yes, if that is what you would like.
Yes, please. I think that's what we would like.
Okay.
Okay.
I do have a couple of announcements, Jamie.
Oh, yeah, sure. Please be my guest.
To take up the 20 minutes. we are starting e-plan probably on June 13th. So we're just introducing it. So just so you know, it's about a 3-month implementation. We still have LMS. I'm not integrating it right away. So it will eventually be easier. And I'm going to look at all of our processes from development engineering, land use, and the permit center and see what is still needed to be able to streamline the system. So I'm using this as one of my tools. But I do want you to know that there probably will be, you know, a month or two of learning curve. We are using the same system as the city of Vancouver, though, to try to help with consistency for our teams.
One thing about that, as you get that online, and I know that we've been experienced, and I've heard some grumblings from our office, is that it takes, you know, once we upload everything, it takes, you know, 2-3 days for things to be routed, and we've had the same issue with the city of Vancouver, that, and I know that, and I don't know if it took that long when we submitted hard copies, but, you know, there's a lag in from the e-plan system, uploading everything, it gets to a tech, the tech reviews everything, counter-complete or whatever, and that might take 3 or 4 days to do that, whereas counter-complete used to be right there. If we had the full, old fully complete certifications, they didn't even do a counter-complete process because it was understood that you have everything submitted that you need to have submitted. So as you move through this, I know that it would be nice to have, and I know it can't be instantaneous necessarily, but that once the, and I don't know the whole inner workings of how this all works, but that once we've uploaded and once the fees are paid, oh crap, I just thought of something.
I think I know what you're talking about.
And then first of all, I don't want to have to email someone to say the fees are paid. I just forgot to do that the other day for a project, so now I got to do that while we're here. And secondly, that there's a lag between uploading and even getting some fees back to us. So although the last one that I did submit, since there is the fully complete for the type 2, type 3, that came through in a couple of hours. So that was, I want to give kudos to the Permit Center for that, but there has been some lag, especially in e-plans with the City of Vancouver, that it takes 3 or 4 or 5 days to even get a confirmation that everything's been accepted.
So that'll be a little different in building permits, and I'm trying to figure out how to adapt that to land use and development engineering. Of course, I understand building permits better than I understand the other two, but I think that the intake appointment is what keeps that from happening, and that's what the City of Vancouver doesn't have. And right now we do it on Teams, and it used to be an hour, and now it's a half an hour, and we're getting better and better at it. But you have that communication back and forth. You're missing this. You don't have this elevation. We can stick it on there really quick, and away you go.
Right.
And so I'm trying to figure out how to adapt that to the other permits.
Okay.
But that's what's helpful, and that will not go away. So where the City of Vancouver will send you an email,
mm-hmm.
you will still do the appointments. So it'll be on your time. So if you put a building permit in, then you request an appointment, but it's going to be looked at that time,
okay.
Just like now,
mm-hmm.
but faster.
Okay.
April, anything else?
Just a reminder that Stormwater 1-5 is starting yesterday. It's going to be going through development engineering with a $345 fee.
Okay. How about that? I was just letting Justin in. Okay. Turning it over to the next item on the agenda, Mr. Odren. Code amendment.
Yeah. So I know we've talked about teeing up some potential biannual code amendments for when staff has staff available to work on these. And aside from the immediacy of the landscape, multifamily landscape thing that we're currently going through, I went through some of the stuff that I've gotten from our staff, and there was only really one item there. So I'm going to talk about a couple things today, and then I'll turn it back over to Jamie, but there's only one real big item that we need to address. This came up and is the first two items in the packet I just handed out to you. This came up on a project where we were trying to establish the lot area on, and I can't remember, I think it was an RC zone parcel, that they might have wanted to have done a land division on. And they were trying to get, people at our office were trying to get an interpretation of how that area, how the lot area is calculated. Typically in the rural zone, the lot area is calculated to the middle of the right-of-way or 30-foot width, whichever is less. And as we were working with one of the planners, it was identified that the code as it reads, if you look on the 4200.040 minimum maximum calculations on the second page, I've highlighted it there. It talks about the urban area except for the UH zones, excludes the street rights of way, obviously. And then it talks about in B, it talks about in these specific zones. Well, there's something missing from that section there, and that is the RC1, the RC2.5, the CR1, and the CR2 zones. All of those, and that's in the second document, or probably the top document that I provided you. And I highlighted that they are rural districts and not urban districts. This took a lot of effort and back and forth, and April, maybe you are familiar with this. And we had to get an opinion from an attorney, a land use attorney, about that, and that we finally got a response from the planner on this project that it seems that legal counsel here at the county has agreed that the right-of-way is calculated in the RC1 and RC2.5 zones. They were silent on the CR1 and CR2 zones. So one of the first things I think that needs to go into any biannual code amendment is section 4200.040C1B needs to be amended to either include those four zones or simply say rural zones. I mean, I don't know if, and I think that with the urban holding sections in there, urban holding could be included as a standalone, because that even though that's an urban zone, it's still identified up above as except for urban holding zones. So that probably hasn't come up because there's not a whole lot of CR and RC zoning in the county, but it needs to be clarified.
Yeah, I can see exactly how that happened, because those zones were added later. So this code was written, it had the zones that were there.
Yep.
I mean, for a while there was another zone, there was a FR20 zone, which would have got excluded as well. Mm. And because, you know, they added by a code change, they added a new zone.
Right.
And it didn't make this reference somewhere else. That happens a lot.
Yeah. And Jamie and I talked, and it sounds like it's simply a Scrivener's error.
It is. Yeah.
So that is the main one that I wanted to talk about today. I was thinking that I had more to discuss, but those are the only ones that I've queried staff at our office about that. So this is what we've got here. The other item that I wanted to bring up for consideration, and I brought this up years ago when we were talking about the difficulty with getting an answer from staff on a question that's project specific, and the time it took for staff to circle the wagons and meet, and it took a week to 2 weeks and all the decisions were based on consensus in their little planning meetings that they have, and understood that there should be some consistency here, and Jamie's enabling reasonableness mantra that I don't think has yet to be fulfilled, we might have an option here. And I've brought this up in the past, and I've brought you the code section here from the City of Vancouver. And the part about it is under 2255.040. And it says here, and I looked in the county code, and staff, correct me if I've missed it. But it reads in each, and for those that aren't here, that don't have a copy of this, it says, the purpose of this is each area of land is to some degree unique as to its suitability for and constraints on development. Development standards and procedures imposed under this zoning code cannot foresee all conceivable situations peculiar to the development of every property at every moment, but are designed as standards applicable to most situations. It is the intent of the adjustment to provide flexibility, adaptability, and reasonableness. Hey, there's that word again. In the application and administration of this title where special conditions exist and the strict application of the standard or procedure would not serve a public purpose. Here's the main part. Planning official authority. In the event the strict application of a development standard or procedural requirement of this title would result in unforeseen consequences or an excessive burden given the nature of the proposed development, the planning official is authorized to make minor adjustments in said standard or procedure upon making a written finding that no person of average sensibilities would be negatively impacted by such an adjustment, and that said adjustment would be consistent with the spirit and intent of this title and the comprehensive plan. No adjustment shall allow a use not otherwise permitted for the subject property, nor shall a minor adjustment be used in place of a variance procedure where applicable. The planning official shall maintain a record of such decisions and associated findings and periodically forward them to the Planning Commission for their information. I think this would take care of a lot of some of those things that come up that in some instances for me in the past, it's, hey, Greg Turner, this isn't working out on this project because of this, that, or the other thing. We would like to do this, and here are the reasons why. It's an email, it's documented, it's sent off. He doesn't get together with it. He might, you know, check in with some of his senior staff or whatever on some of this stuff, and then he'll get back to us in like a day or two and with an answer. Either no, because, or certainly, you make a good argument. Thank you. I don't think the county has anything like this. And I think that that would speed things up a little bit as far as getting some answers on exactly what this section talks about. So I would submit for consideration when we do the biannual code amendments. And I know that this has to go through PC and the council, but that a similar code section be added to the Unified Development Code.
The first biannual code amendments, because there are so many, we're doing the easy ones first. So we're doing the scripter errors first, because we've never done it before. Planning has always done it. Now, community development is going to be doing it. None of us have really done it before. So we're going to do the easy ones first, learn the process, then we will tackle the more difficult ones. This is a more difficult one. We do have something similar, which is under compliance and the responsible official authority. You can ask for my interpretation in writing, and you can bring it to a hearings examiner and have it appealed.
Yeah, but it's not the same. Trust me, it's not the same.
So maybe that you're saying this one's a little bit, this one's a little bit too significant to make the biannuals this time. What about the one Mike just brought off about the RC?
I wrote that one down. That one, yes.
That about, one can? Yes. Okay. And yep. What about our previous motion on the cottage code with the garages? Because we had a previous motion from this board. Basically, there was an issue with the interpretation of the cottage, the garages, having to count against the square footage. And we had a motion on the next biannual code changes that was supposed to get included. And we were hoping to get an interim, you know, interpretation, but we really haven't had that yet. So
weren't you working on that, Brent? I know. Well, maybe you weren't working on it. I know that you provided the county's interpretation of it.
Correct. So there hasn't been any work on a code amendment. So I think, you know, that should be on April's list. You know, it may need to be coordinated with the housing options study and action plan because there may be some crossover there.
But didn't we establish that it was a It was an oversight?
It was
Boston, just basically an oversight.
They pulled a code from another jurisdiction that happened to use a term that we had in our code defined for something else.
That's right.
And that's what happened. I mean, I have the history on it, and that's how that became. So it's basically a Scrivener's error or an unintended consequence.
Mm-hmm.
The intentions were good. All the examples we looked at never included the garage. We went through tons of examples showing like what these cottages look like. We never included the garage in any of those. That was all like afterward because we had another term in there that we pulled from some other jurisdiction's cottage code that talked about gross area, and we had gross area for a fire code thing that had everything inside the structure. It didn't even relate. I mean, whenever we look at square footages for homes in any of the building codes, it never includes that. It's a fire code thing, though.
Yeah, in any home.
It's a combustible area.
It's a 2,000-square-foot home with a 900-square-foot garage.
Yeah, so combustible area, yes, it applies for fire code. But because we had that term in there, it carried over, and it kind of, you know, messed up the
That has code. Caused no cottage projects to move forward.
Yeah, we have some that are approved that are waiting for that change.
Oh, really?
Yep.
Would you then have to go back through?
They won't build because they're not cost-effective. And we're looking at really trying to have these middle housing options. But if you have something that kills it where, all right, the development's done, they move forward with it, they need this code change before they'll actually put something on the ground.
Gotcha.
Because it doesn't work. And it's not cost-effective. So we're not going to have those entry-level homes that are really needed in our community because of a goof up in the code. So I would suggest, can we get that one in there? We already made a motion that was already there that we make that change. I want to make sure that the development community stuff doesn't get overlooked when they do it, and it's just the staff Scrivener error thing. So we've been waiting a long time for some of these items, so
right.
It'd be nice to have those in this batch as well. Stuff that's not new stuff we're bringing up now, but stuff we already, you know, voted on and moved forward.
Right.
So
I believe that I've heard that come up a couple of times in Oliver's presentations about affordable housing. And so I do think that I will have to ask Oliver, but I do think that one would not be considered, that one's still going to be something bigger than an error in the code.
Hmm. Well, I mean, maybe we can get some of these in there, though.
That's
it's a big issue. I mean, it's kind of like the landscape one, too. So
If I don't find a resolution next week, I am putting the landscape versus rec space one in there.
Okay.
So that's all I had for this discussion. Jamie, did you want to talk about any of yours?
Yeah. Mike, it might be easier because I'm getting a little bit of an echo to start with the Eve one, and then we can move to the variance items. Maybe have you bring it up.
You want me to talk about yours?
Well, I guess I could talk about it.
I think Jamie need to at least give some background as far as what the proposal is and maybe a little bit of history, but I mean, I know we talked about it earlier today. You did have some concurrence with past legal counsel and not necessarily with current legal counsel, right?
Yeah, well, let me begin with the low-hanging fruit one. One of the ones that we've had a lot of issues with over the years is side setbacks related to eaves and gutters on buildings. And the way that the code reads now, for instance, is it's supposed to be, I think, what did we decide, Mike? Like a 5-foot setback? Between.
Oh, that's right. I thought you were talking about the other one. Yeah, that is the low-hanging fruit, and I can give a little bit of background on that.
Okay, let's do that one, and then I'll turn to the harder one.
Okay, so one of the items that's come up is related to a project called Cole's Landing. It was a project that it was in one of our projects. It was actually my project quite a few years back, and we went with really small lots, and we had reductions for 3-foot side yard setbacks, which is a 6-foot building separation. And so when they started building the buildings, they built several buildings, and they always have some kind of overhang or eave on the side yards coming off of the roof line. And the code specifically states that the eaves, cornices, and a number of different things can increase, encroach into the side yard setback by up to 2 feet. That's codified. These particular eaves were extending 18 inches into the side yard setback. So there was still a 3 foot building separation, meaning that there was a 3 feet between the eaves. They of course had to meet the fire rating requirement as far as their separation was concerned. But later on, as additional houses were being built, it appears that the setback was being measured from the, by staff from the eaves rather than from the walls. And I don't know why this this changed course. There, Jamie sent a memo to Marty and Susan when they were still around, and essentially stating that's the case, and that and I'm sorry, Jamie, I didn't read this verbatim, and I don't plan on doing it right now. But the bottom line is that we just want to get established and memorialized that building setbacks from other buildings are, even from property lines, are from the building walls, not from the eaves. Good. Then that's something that we need to get memorialized too. In fact, I've run into some situations with multifamily building setbacks to where I'm now setting them off. You know, if there's a 10-foot setback, I'll set them off 11 feet. Just to make sure that if they measure to the, and I don't know why it would be, most of these setbacks are number one to provide a buffer and a separation between adjacent properties. But why do you care if it's underground? Number two, it's a fire rating and fire protection requirement, whereas the foundation is concrete and again underground. So I don't know why they are measuring setbacks from. And what are they hanging their hat on then? That's the other question, is why they do that. They should be hanging their hat on what it says in the code. So we just want to make sure that as building permits are coming in for not only this project but for other projects that have established setbacks on either the face of the plat, or whether they have building envelopes, or they indicated in the decision, that those are being measured from the building walls to the property lines, or from the building walls to building walls, not from the farthest projection on the particular building, because there is a separate code section that talks about specific things that can encroach into front, side, rear yard setbacks, bay windows, cornices, eaves, and a number of different items. So I don't know if this is being interpreted this way still, Jamie. I don't know what the latest on this is, or if it's just kind of sitting out there in la-la land and no plane has been landed.
We've had it come up from time to time on other projects. As I told you on the phone, Mike, a lot of Oregon builders, this is pretty common practice, but Clark County has had this strict interpretation that causes this issue. Again, it should be measured from the foundation or the sidewall, not the overhang, which is meant to provide some architectural interest, but also has a function of keeping the water out.
Mm-hmm.
There's another similar issue that comes up with that same interpretation. Then that's when there's an easement that is in the setback that was intended to be basically between the buildings and the setback. So say you have buildings 10 feet apart and there's a 10-foot sewer easement through there.
Mm-hmm.
Now, the same language that has that encroachment on the building setback may be fuzzy on whether you can encroach on the easement itself.
Mm.
So something similar, and it's the intention is really clear, but the interpretation can be a little fuzzy. So, but very related to what you guys are just what you're talking about.
So easement encroachments of these very same items into
easements.
Into easements.
Yeah.
Well, there's no built. Okay.
Especially like drainage easements. We'll have that a lot, you know, and they're just intended drainage easements. Yeah. And they're intended to basically, they were set inside the building setbacks to be the same thing. And how about a habitat buffer? Something like that too. If you're setting the building setback line
right.
on a buffer line,
mm-hmm.
what about encroachments then? Like they all.
One could say that is the building envelope.
Envelope, yeah. So the envelope versus.
And you can encroach out outside of the building envelope.
Yeah. I mean, it doesn't impact vegetation.
Right.
It doesn't impact anything. I mean, it's above the ground. I mean, it might
That's
affect the shadow a little bit, but those come up maybe even more than the setback issue.
That's a good one that we need to get resolved. Okay.
Well,
good.
Partly with the housing affordability county is moving forward with, obviously, middle housing is going to get tighter and going to get more of these conflicts. Get some resolution.
So I don't think we have anybody from the building department on today. If they are, can you chime up? Crickets. Okay. If staff could check in on this for us, at least with whomever would be the best, whether it be Jim or somebody else, to make sure that they understand that the building setbacks are not from the closest element. That they're measured from the walls and that there's a separate code section that regulates what can encroach into side, front, backyard, or rear yard setbacks specific. And there wouldn't be that code section in there that talked about that if the condition is what the building department is saying it is, or whatever your situation has come up, Jamie. There wouldn't be a need for that because it would be from the farthest point on a building, regardless of what it is, that's where you need to recognize a setback. But that's not what it is.
I'll talk to Dan and Jim.
Okay, thank you. All right, I took care of one ears.
Okay, do you want to turn to the setbacks in the rural area and talk about our discussion that you had there?
Oh, yeah, let's see.
Just more philosophical, Mike, about...
Sure. Yeah, let's talk about that a little bit.
Yeah.
Let's talk about that a little bit. All right. We'll just open this up for a little bit of discussion. Both Jamie and I have had, we found out just today when we were talking this morning, very similar circumstances from a code enforcement standpoint. Client builds something, doesn't meet setbacks, code enforcement, how do you resolve it? Well... in order to meet the setbacks, you need to get a boundary line adjustment. Well, that's not always been the case. In fact, I approached my recent project such that we looked at a no-build easement on the neighbor's property to the north, which would effectively prevent the... In setbacks, again, we need to get back to the reason behind them. In the rural areas in which I was located, it's a fire protection issue. Maybe it's some, retaining the rural character. Still not sure why there's a 50-foot front yard setback in a lot of the rural areas. But when you get to code enforcement and you have a situation where they built something, hey, they as Jamie and I talked, that they have to own up to it too, and they're doing it, after the fact and doing what they can in order to rectify the situation and to take care of the code enforcement action and to kind of move on with their lives. They're really kind of stuck now because Jamie had a project or a situation very similar to where he was working with Horn and did you say Lowry might have been involved with this too? Yeah, so
yes.
So the two past civil PA PAs were talking about, it's right on top. They had talked about, hey, would it work out such that we record an easement if the neighboring property would grant an easement, no-build easement, so that we can, you know, use that in order to meet setback requirements, because there's a fire separation, and you don't want buildings built too close and things of that nature. And so they actually proceeded with recording, paying the neighbor who granted them an easement much greater than what they absolutely what they needed for that particular area. And this was in the rural area too, right? The side yard, 20-foot side yard. Neighbor built a carport to house their to cover their RV. It was too close to the property line. Code enforcement. The no-build easements have worked in the past. I think that there is some precedent, and I've asked Jamie to look at some case law as far as that's concerned. In my circumstance, in Jamie's circumstance, when he went to the new the last two civil PAs, and I went to staff, that they would not accept a no-build easement. I even attempted to look at doing an exclusive easement, which would effectively not allow the neighboring property to use that easement at all. It effectively moves the property line. Staff did not agree that that met the requirements for setbacks. And so we've been in one situation, one circumstance in the past where staff and the PA's office were looking at alternatives to take care of issues such as this, that were thinking outside the box, were a win-win for everyone. What Jamie and I are having a difficulty getting our arms around in both these circumstances is the easements, whether non-exclusive or exclusive easements, and provide the necessary safety measures. It's what these should come down to is the health, safety, and welfare of the general public, and protection of said health, safety, and welfare. And we're trying to figure out what other alternatives there are to. I got lucky in this instance. In my instance, the neighbor to the north was my client's brother-in-law. They agreed to do a boundary line adjustment, which is ideally what you'd want to do, of course. However, in Jamie's situation, he said, no, hell no, and please don't ask again, but I will grant you that easement. In fact, I'll sell you an easement. They've got an easement. It's been recorded, and they're done, and now they're stuck with the situation where the alternative is to tear down the six-figure carport and move on from there. And so to no one's benefit, not to the county's benefit, not to the client's benefit, you know, he's not only paid for the construction, and granted, they didn't know the setbacks. They should have known that at the time. And I don't know in Jamie's circumstance whether he got a building permit or not. And this oftentimes happens where they don't get building permits and they get stuck. They have to permit after the fact. But it just appears that, and I don't know what other jurisdictions do. I asked Jamie that. He said this has worked in other jurisdictions just fine. I know that, you know, Clark County really doesn't care what Snohomish County does or vice versa, but it does happen, and it does meet the requirements for effectively providing the required setbacks. So this is more of a discussion item. I don't know if staff has really dug their feet in, and they've probably gone to legal counsel, and they've said no because Jamie's already tried this once before. But, you know, we're just kind of opening this up for discussion now and see if anybody else has anything similar or other solutions that we might see, or how we might otherwise find a solution to these. Now, one of these solutions could be a variance procedure and changing the variance language such that the review authority, and here's some draft language that Jamie has worked on, and I'll read it out loud for those. I didn't even make copies for everyone here. So this is under the application for a type 2 review for variance. And of course, the A states, you know, more than 10% and up to including 25%. And then B, it says up to 10% or more on more than one lot, and then there or, and then we have a new section C, which reads, the review authority may permit and authorize a variance from the requirements of this title only when unusual circumstances cause undue hardship in the application of this title. A type 2 variance of this type shall be made only when all of the following conditions and facts exist. And there's five. Unusual circumstances or conditions apply to the property and or to the intended use that do not apply generally to the other property in the same vicinity or district. And such variance is necessary for the preservation and enjoyment of a substantial property right of the applicant possessed by the owners of other properties in the same vicinity and district or district. And the authorization of such variance will not be materially detrimental to the public welfare or injurious to the property in the vicinity or district in which it's located, and that the granting of such a variance will not adversely affect the realization of the comprehensive plan. Should an objection to the variance request be filed, it would move to a type 3 process as specified below. So, and then Jamie also has another case similar to this that, should this be part of the code, would also provide an alternative route for those that may not have all followed the rules and but are looking to get right. So I need to take a drink. Jamie, you?
You said it very well.
Thank you.
So
I don't know.
What I would just say is, I think that the theme is what you suggested earlier with the language from the City of Vancouver code, and that's trying to introduce a modicum of reasonableness in the county code, because right now, oftentimes, you get these strict interpretations, oftentimes out of cases from code enforcement or ones like the Coles Landing, where the building's already built, and then you have to find a you have to work through that at that point. Well, it makes no sense for the county to require a structure of significant value to get be torn down, and yet that's where the code is going to lead you to. And as I told Mike this morning, it's, you know, these codes are designed thinking that we live in a two-dimensional, perfectly square universe, not recognizing that you're applying that over a natural environment that's in three dimensions, and it has different natural features in it. And moreover, with these setbacks, especially in the rural area, these critical area ordinances have been implemented since these codes went into existence. It keeps creeping and creeping and creeping, and you're getting smaller and smaller building envelopes that create problems. And so, you know, here on a couple of these cases, and I know Mike's has been really long too, we've been banging our heads with staff for years trying to get to solutions, and every turn we propose, and there's other ones in some of these other cases, and you know, whether it be long range or other silos within the county say don't go there. That's not acceptable. We've got to have a modicum of reasonableness here and a tool to get there. And this variance procedure would be a method of doing that, and give some authority and discretion to the community development director to make those calls on an equitable basis. That language that I had provided Mike that he just read out was stuff that I had been working on with Chris Horn prior to his retirement, and it sort of sat in a stack of stuff, and then he went out the door, and the ball sort of never got picked up and ran with. And I felt like I was starting to make progress with Taylor right prior to the pandemic happening, and then that's basically put a halt to all code amendments for now, what are we, 2.5 years? And so, again, I think, April, this is not an easy Scrivener's fix issue, but it is very important that we get something like this or a tool like this into code to give some sort of reasonableness to try to work through some of these things, because just I find it really hard to believe that the county wants to get to a result where structures, you know, worth $500,000 or potentially more get torn down. That's just there's a legal concept called waste, and I can't accept that.
Can I ask a question? Because I, yes. The piece I'm struggling is, like, I'm not a developer, I'm not an engineer, okay, so this might not be popular, but I'm struggling with why are we trying to not penalize the people who did it in the first place? So I guess my question is, are there scenarios where this happens that it's not just someone not submitting permits, right? Well, is there a scenario?
Let me talk about the last instance. In that case, it involved a rural property, and county code allows you to do an exempt land division of 20 acres or more. And so in that factual case, the property owner, may or may not have done that, and it was complying with both state law and county code in that regard. And yet, because it doesn't meet the zoning there, and despite the fact that that parcel is of similar size to all of it around, this property just happens to have an FR 40 zone on it. The county's position is well, regardless of whether or not you're exempt from a land division, you are still required to meet zoning, and therefore that's not a good building. And so the county's essentially put folks into a trap in some regard with one code saying you're authorized to do something, and then, you know, claiming you're not. That's a problem. Some of these other instances with setbacks, I think Mike's fact pattern was described to me as such, like, it, you know, the client did something, and then these after effects made his issue non-conforming. Or oftentimes we'll have like a carport, which isn't a building by building code or the International Residential Code, and yet the county staff is taking this interpretation position that is also required to meet setbacks as if it were the side of the house again. And so there's a lot of stuff there that innocent people are getting tripped up on, and it needs solutions, especially in light of the fact that you're talking about substantial amounts of structural value, and nobody wins if it gets torn down. That's just, the county loses tax revenue, the homeowner loses value, and I've yet to hear good justifications in a lot of these circumstances of why that needs to be, why such a harsh result needs to happen.
So then I guess my follow-up question, thank you for that, because the scenarios that you penciled seemed to be only scenarios where people just didn't follow the rules. And so I was struggling to grasp that.
That's very much the case, Sherry. In a lot of these cases, it's a situation where in my client's situation was he hired a contractor to build a cabin for him. The contractor didn't get any permits. It was built. They did an addition. Got caught. There were no permits. Went to code enforcement, and if the contractor for my client had applied for a building permit, they would have said, "Oh, well, you have to go through a shorelines process. You don't meet setback requirements." At least I don't know, as if there may have been different setback requirements back in the 80s when it was built. But you have to jump through all these hoops and get it properly permitted. That happens, that's something that happened a lot back in the day, you know, kind of cowboy things together. It's never done maliciously, though, in a lot of these circumstances where they simply just, I would hope not any trick now, where they just kind of thumb their nose and say, well, I don't need to get a permit or anything for this. I'm just going to go ahead and do it. Sometimes they do. And yeah, as Jamie and I talked about today, we were very upfront with our clients that you should have known what your contractor was doing, and no, you should have gotten a permit for that. And if you had, you wouldn't be in this situation now. But now that we are in those situations, how best to take care of them without, again, tearing down structures? Some of them that have been there for, you know, 40 years, some that are brand new, whatever it might be. We don't like code enforcement projects. When we get a call for code enforcement, you guys like code enforcement? No, nobody here likes code enforcement.
There's no, never a solution. There's no way
right.
to ever make it compliant.
Right.
Yes, should they vote no? Should it be painful? It's already painful.
Yeah.
Well, so then I guess my follow-up question is maybe more county-specific, because so this is happening in my neighborhood right now, so this is, like, really familiar. People, someone didn't follow setback rules. Mm-hmm. They built something, and then the neighbor saw that they did it, and they built something. And then so this is just something that I'm learning a lot about, and so
sure.
I'm curious. is what – so on the other side, what does it look like when someone breaks the code? Like, what is the process right now?
I can help you with that. I also have code enforcement under my umbrella. And a couple of things. I don't want to talk about the specific one because Jamie is his attorney and I don't feel comfortable talking about that specific one. But that can happen. So first and foremost, 99% of code enforcement cases are complaint driven. So their neighbor has called them in. And we have to investigate. And what you know, when we say that it's a victimless crime when you build a shed or a carport on your property line, it's not, because then your neighbor, it is now theirs to deal with. Just because they adhered to a 30-foot setback, so now, yeah, your structure is 30 feet away from mine, but it should be 60. And a lot of times in the rural areas, it is because of fire and slopes and trees, and we can reduce some setbacks, so you don't have to be, we'll take you out of WUI if we think that you don't have as bad of slopes, or if it's been cleared and there isn't a fire danger. But in a neighborhood, too, you have the neighbors see they did it, and then the neighbors see they did it, and then everybody has fixtures that are too close, and if the fire goes through there, they're in trouble. So I will tell you that I have a new code enforcement manager. She started at the same time I did. She is extremely reasonable. And she does want to find a path forward, always. I mean, always. She always thinks that we can figure something out, and it keeps her up at night when we don't.
Well, thank you for clarifying all of this. So my last question would be on the variation, or whatever we just talked about, the variance.
The variance, yeah.
Yeah. Is the goal there, then, is to give the county more discretion on a case-by-case
right.
basis?
Reasonable.
Because of... Reasonableness, yeah. A variance is it's a variance to a numerical standard, meaning it's a number of parking stalls for commercial. It's a setback. It's something that is required in code that has a number associated with it, except for density, I believe, is the only exception to that. And when it comes to density transfer, I think it's density transfer that doesn't apply. Anyway. So say that again. That's interesting.
On a stated standard, you know, so it says I'm trying to remember exactly what our we had requested a variance, and they said, no, that's because within the code, it states a number.
And I'd be interested in knowing what that is.
But we've actually requested a variance. Do you remember? It was actually on PLS, and that was with Travis, so. And we got hit by it and said, no.
Anyway, most numerical standards you can apply for a variance on. And there are different levels of them. There's a type 1, which is up to 10% of the numerical standard. Type 2, which is 10% up to and including 25% of the numerical standard. Then there's a type 3. So both of those are administratively reviewed. Type 3 is anything over 25%, but you have to meet the variance criteria. Well, you have to meet the variance criteria in all circumstances, but it's more of a challenge to meet it for the type 3 setback requirements or type 3 variance requirements. And that also requires going to a public hearing, which again is costly and, so we're looking for, and oftentimes type 3 variances are not approved. I have never applied for a type 3 variance. And in my circumstance, I was told by staff that I probably wouldn't meet the criteria for a type 3 variance, which is why we had to find some other alternative route. So, and yeah, it's not the situation where, as Eric said, it's painful for them once they realize, oh crap, you're right, I got caught, hoping I wouldn't. But then we come in and try to fix it. And as their consultant or their attorney, we try to work with staff as far as finding some sort of solution. But, you know, I lucked out in my situation, or my client lucked out in his situation. I don't know if Jamie's client is going to luck out in his situation or situations, or if all of them are somehow resolved, to the satisfaction of both the property owner and staff, to where they can finally put it to bed. I don't know what the instances of that would be, but I'd be interested in knowing, how often is it that, and this isn't just a, hey, you've done a bunch of grading without a grading permit. That's easy. Once you've built a structure and put concrete in the ground and run utilities and if you've been in there a long time, now you have memories and everything else associated with it. It's those sorts of things that sometimes, are a little more challenging. So.
Thank you all for educating me on this.
Certainly, stick around long enough, one of us will hire you as a planner.
I think I have a planner position open now.
I have to leave the floor, just apologizing in advance. So.
I had a Scrivener error that's bit me a couple different times.
Oh, okay.
And I know that the housing options, Phil Weiss brought it up, and it's where's my little note here? I just looked it up. It's D, and it's a calculation of a maximum density. And if I calculate maximum density and I'm proposing apartments on there, I don't have to include any of the site roads. If I'm proposing townhouses, I have to have a subtraction for proposed right-of-ways. Even if I can make more density, if I can meet the minimum on the lot sizes that's allowed in code. Mm-hmm. I've been bitten by this pretty hard once. I lost 10% of my lots. And on the other one, we just knew it was going to come through, so we redesigned it, and we lost about, I think, was 6 lots on that one. So
run that by us again, Dan, please.
So if I'm on the code reads, mm-hmm. maximum density shall be calculated based upon the gross area of the site, excluding public right-of-way or street easements. If I propose it as apartments, I do not have to include any of the internal driveways,
right.
any of the internal
parking lots
mm-hmm. or whatever. Mm-hmm. If I propose townhouses,
everything that is.
You have to take out all of your.
All public roads, all private roads, all shared driveways, all have to be excluded. They all have to, they're excluded in the gross area. So then, therefore, then it'll go through a calculation. Okay? So if I propose apartments, I can have a bigger density, even if, and so the lots, even if the lot size meets minimum, I've still been bit by, on the one I can think of, we came back and we had 29 lots is what we got pushed back to. I could have put in 33 townhouse lots and still met the minimum lot size. That's the one that tripped it. And another one, we had 80, we end up with 83 and we could have got to 89. So
where's the error? What would need to be?
What's that? No.
No.
The other way around.
The maximum density should be
excluding existing. It should say existing public right-of-way or street easements. Because that's how it's interpreted for apartments, because there is no, you know,
internal. Yeah.
It's all internal stuff.
What about perimeter?
So the perimeter is, that's the existing.
Yeah. But what if you have to dedicate additional right-of-way on the perimeter?
That's would be part of the existing.
Okay.
So those, that would be part of the existing.
It's the internal circulation.
Right. And again, it was based upon the, if we can meet the minimum size of the existing lots that are required for that zoning in that code.
220.
We should be able to have the maximum density as if I was building apartments with the only, again, this is for maximum density. So
right.
If you're only subtracting out existing, you should be consistent with that. And I think that's a clarification or a Scribner's error.
So. Agreed. Yeah.
020.
Ran into that before as well.
020, you said 6D.
6D.
No, it should be C, 6D, maybe?
Is that what it is?
Development standards. Yeah, there it is.
Yeah. Can I suggest that somebody kind of compiles all of these? I have that on my plate, but if someone else
No. I'll do that.
Okay.
I'll do that. I don't have the cottage. I don't have the cottage language, though, that we want to propose.
Okay.
So.
It's in one of our old motions. It's the I can send it to you, though, if you
have. Oh, it'll be on our website, right?
Yep.
Okay.
Well, it'll, yeah, it was the, basically not the garages.
Okay.
There's a bunch of documentation I'm sure you have on your emails, but I can send it to you as well.
Yeah, if you could do that, that'd just make things a little simpler.
And I think, like, to get all those compiled in a document that we could, like,
make that way staff has it all together. And we don't need to piecemeal it to them so they can get it all at once.
I think it'll be a lot easier for staff to digest it if they don't have to do that work. If we look at the format that they've used for biannual codes, there's basically, here's the requested change, here's the rationale.
Right.
And if we can do something like that, it would make it so much easier for staff to say, yeah, maybe we can include this one, because a lot of their work's already done. So.
You got to go.
Any other notes we need before I go?
Before we go, and this is a little off topic, if I might, Jamie, we had a discussion last week about wet stamps.
Yes, and I don't know that was totally resolved.
No, somebody's going to look into it. The county accepts digital stamps. That's right. Right? Jennifer?
I think there's a little confusion with the term digital and electronic, because digital means something completely different than electronic does. Digital means that it's like certified by, it's an electronic document that's certified digitally. Like you're not writing your, or you're not doing your signature and dating the PD stamp. It's digitally signed. I think you guys know what I'm talking about. That's not accepted on a hard copy set of plans. We need an electronic signature, which is the your, you know, written signature on your PE stamp with the date. Does that make sense?
Can you?
Kind of. I guess it'd be like two examples, what's not accepted and what is, so we can make sure we get it right.
Yeah.
And then we can like debate it a little bit.
I think so too. Jennifer, can you put in an email to Deeb what you are indicating that you're needing for this so that we can send it out to others and then double check with what the state requirements are? And I think this is a pretty low hanging fruit and we can put it to bed pretty quick, but when it came up about wet stamps, we're like, huh? Nobody does wet stamps anymore.
Right, and I think that that was, the term was used incorrectly. It didn't, it wasn't meant to say wet. And I think there was a lot of confusion and there shouldn't be, we didn't change anything. I think, and I wanna say like that Olson does it correctly. Especially with how they do the preliminary, I think we're getting a lot of a lot of preliminary plans submitted to us that have the signatures and the dates on it, and that's what's kind of leading to the confusion as to what the requirements are. You should only be signing and stamping and dating your stamp with the final approved documents.
Right.
Anything else should say preliminary.
I think the challenge is the way the PDFs are created and how the stamp is applied, because we use something called Bluebeam, and it basically sends an email and the engineer has to say, yes, apply my digital stamp. And they have a signature that they wrote in there and they put it in the software and it gets put in after they've like allowed it to be put in. And the advantage to that is the way the PDF is created, it is a lot more size efficient versus a scan. So I think what the county hasn't had an issue is when someone actually physically signs it,
They scan it.
And that is now, is that digital? Is that electronic? I think that's digital, right? I don't even know anymore.
No. That's right. Digital. It's electronic. What you've been describing is electronic in both.
Okay.
In both instances is electronic, not digital.
Okay. Hold on. Is Bluebeam electronic or is the scan electronic?
Both are electronic.
Okay. So are both accepted?
As far as our paper documents, yes.
Okay. So I think there might still be confusion. So what we try to do is on the PDF thing, it's in Bluebeam. It applies a signed version of theirs, but it inserts it in the document and puts a little, I think, tag on it saying it's like when it was applied. And the difference is those PDFs are a lot more useful for archiving. When you guys get these for your archives, you can actually manipulate layers in those PDFs. They're much smaller. You could say, you know, I'd like to see this, but the shading's very, it's like masking things. You can physically go in and turn that layer off, and you can turn the shading off on the document. So it makes it a lot more useful to the county, but I think those are the situations where they're like, no, we need it scanned in. And that can be a problem.
PDF needs to be flattened. You can't be able to manipulate the PDF after you've applied the stamp. Like you can't. Be able to manipulate those layers.
You're not manipulating it. You're just turning stuff on and off.
Right. But still, that's manipulation.
I think that situation is during the review process. You can turn things on and off, but once you've got the final.
Yeah, I mean.
Maybe, it has to be. It has to be.
You can't change anything in it.
No.
You can just turn certain things on and off to be able to view it better. Like hatching and shading and things like that.
Jennifer, if you could do us a favor and just send out a quick memo to Deeb and we'll take a look and send it out, we'd appreciate it. Just so that we're all on the same page, there's no question. Would you mind doing that?
Right, and I can, but I don't know if I'm addressing the issues that you're having because...
Oh, okay. Well, send yours out. Okay, maybe send out the quick memo to Deeb, and then if there are questions, then we can continue that conversation. You and Eric can continue that conversation.
So what would you like clarified exactly then? What should the
matter I think the difference between what's digital, what's electronic.
I think that the state has issued something like that. And so it's just.
So you just follow the state's requirements?
Yes. But there's.
I don't know. I'm not an engineer. You guys tell me. Is this an issue?
Yeah.
Are we wasting our time?
Yeah. I mean,
Andrew?
It might be. It might be fine. I mean,
okay.
If there's an example of what's not allowed, I guess we need that.
That'd be good.
Provide us that.
Yeah.
And then say, and then we can look at it and say, here's what we can do instead. Because I'm not sure exactly. The stuff we've been submitting has been fine for years, and all of a sudden one project came up. And it was on.
Right.
Yeah, you had the same thing happen?
No, I had.
Okay.
That's the issue.
Yeah, that's what happens. And we have the software that, you know, we did to allow for more functionality, the PDFs, to be able to apply things during COVID especially. They've changed the way they do this. Like AutoCAD has a software that you apply your signatures. It's kind of like a DocuSign. And it may just be that the code has not caught up with the technology. And maybe there's an adjustment that needs to be made.
Well,
but,
I'll let you guys figure it out.
Sounds good.
Because if Olson's doing it fine, I'm not going to worry about it. All right. That's all I had again, Jamie. Thanks.
Hey, one item with code amendments. I think there is the discussion of road mods with sight distance across the corner lots and the driveways and being able to park in those. I believe Deeb previously, a couple of years ago maybe, came up with proposed language on that. So that was one of those I think has already been discussed, and transportation folks have, I believe, accepted it, and it might be an easy one to do this round.
Yeah, I remember I worked on that committee with Eric and some others, and I believe that's correct, Seth. And so that would be Mike, if we could just dig out that findings from that group.
Yeah, I'll in all my free time, I'll go ahead and try to pull this all together. I anticipate August of 2024. Is that okay? That's about the right time you'll be getting around to this, right?
Fair enough.
Can you? This
yeah,
is Jennifer,
no, I'll get it together. Sorry, Jennifer,
can you
go ahead.
Forward that language to me, because I'm the one actually writing up that specific change.
Oh,
so that
okay.
That would be helpful if
yeah.
I could see what your language was from a couple years ago. I kind of have a gist of what it should be changed, but I want to make sure that we're both on the same page.
Okay. Can do.
That we're on the same corner.
Yeah.
Okay. Before I talk about the meeting next month, is there any public comment? I know Justin's here online, and Noelle, do you want to introduce yourself as the new BIA Government Affairs Director back there with the public time?
Hi, I'm Noelle. I'm the new Government Affairs Director for the BIA of Clark County. I'm here just learning a lot and immersing myself in all this information. I come from a background in government affairs, but not in the building industry. I've done some work with the healthcare and with mining, kind of very opposite industries. So I feel like I can dive right in here. So I have a few cards if anybody wants one. But yeah, happy to be here and just learn. Thanks.
And Justin, are you still online? Do you want to introduce your new position?
Still on mute.
Justin.
Yeah. Hello, everyone. I am the new Government Affairs Director. My name is Justin Wood. I am the new Government Affairs Director for the Clark County Association of Realtors. So I'm very excited to be in this position and looking forward to maybe seeing all of you in person next time.
So Justin's with Paul. So the next meeting is July 7th. I'm assuming everybody's going to be here.
Except me.
I will be on an airplane, so I won't be here.
Dan Moore, okay.
Hang on.
We'll go ahead and go forward.
I will not be here.
You will not be here, Mike?
I won't.
Maybe I'll circulate a email to confirm everybody's availability, just to make sure we lock that down.
Okay.
Just by happenstance, I happened to be in the field on Monday, and I ran into Dave Howe, who's now the regional program manager for Washington Department of Fish and Wildlife. And he had asked what was going on with Deeb, and it started a nice conversation. And I would like to propose having them come in to give us an update on what they're working on, as well as, since we're moving into the growth management plan update, how we can sort of get ahead of some of these issues in terms of the environment and environment. And I know he sent was it yesterday, Brent?
Today.
Today. Okay.
Yeah, that'd be cool.
So if that works for everybody, I'll extend the invitation with Brent and make sure I'm come in. And then other than that, it sounds like we're going to have stuff maybe more back. And is there anything else in the July agenda?
There's nothing from staff at this time.
And I don't think we've discussed anything either, Jamie.
Okay.
Probably well, time to look at that, our work plan, see what we can take up. Because right now, I think we're in a good position that we're not being reactive to certain things that have come up, that we can now start being a little more proactive and you know, talk about, discuss, resolve some of those other items that are looming out there. And if there's nothing looming out there, great. I think there's always.
Well, I think we will have direction from the board next week on the buildable lands report. And so I think understanding maybe where that landed would be important, because I think a lot of what we're going to be working on the next couple of years is going to be sort of GMA-esque related. And so. But to your point, I'll look at the work plan and see if what other items we may put on the agenda for next month.
And then just send out a reminder to the rest of the board, and we can take a look at it ourselves too, and see if anything that jogs us to
jumps out.
Put something on the agenda.
Okay.
Cool.
With that, I guess we're adjourned until next month. Appreciate everybody's time.
Thanks, Jamie.
Thank you.
Cheers.